Tim Hortons TCNT. Tell us where you work, why you want Tim Hortons coffee and Timbits and treats. And this Thursday, we're going to be delivering our first gift of Tim Hortons and coffee and Timbits to your office. So again, to get in the running, the more times you tweeted us, the more opportunities you have. Use that hashtag Tim Hortons TCNT, and Justice Andrew will bring coffee to you. 651-989-5855. Right now, Foundation for Defense of Democracy, senior fellow there, defenddemocracy.org, and author of Bin Laden's Legacy, and friend of the show, David Garchenstein Ross. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. It's great to join you.
I've got an updated story here from when we talked about it earlier this morning. The death toll from the Somalia bombings, this is out of Reuters, has jumped to over 300. The number killed in the twin bombings in Mogadishu has risen to more than 300, according to the city's the head of the city's ambulance service. And they expect that death toll to continue to rise. This is already being called the deadliest attack on record in Mogadishu. What do we know so far about this attack, David?
So in terms of attribution, the assumption right now, which I think will prove accurate, is that this was the work of al-Shabaab, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. You know, ISIS also has a presence in Somalia, though they're nowhere near as capable as Shabaab. Shabaab, over the years, its attacks have been increasing in lethality and complexity. It's a militant group that used to control the majority of southern Somalia until an African Union force called AMISOM, it says for the African Union Mission in Somalia, pushed them back from their stronghold there. But since they lost their last major urban area a few years ago, Shabaab has become increasingly capable as an insurgent force. We've seen a lot of attacks recently over the past few years in hotels in Mogadishu. There's a number of reasons for that, but they want to make Mogadishu unsafe and insecure for foreigners. They want to particularly attack hotels, which are vulnerable targets. They're targets that al-Qaeda has become very proficient at attacking in Africa. And this attack, bomb-based attack, which basically leveled the entirety of the Safari Hotel, is extremely lethal, tragic, and indicative of just how bad these things can be.
Now, we've talked about al-Shabaab before in our discussions with you, not something that you traditionally hear in any of the mainstream media in the United States. We'll be discussing here in a moment the ISIS fighters in Raqqa and the coalition battle there. Is al-Shabaab a group that's growing in strength? Is this an organization linked with al-Qaeda that could become a larger threat to the West?
So there's no question that it's growing in strength. The reason it's very clear is because I've been mapping for years the attacks in Somalia, and one can clearly see that the range of attacks, that is how geographically dispersed they are, is growing. The group is increasingly capable of striking into Kenya, though over the past few years its Kenya attacks have actually declined somewhat as it's gotten more opportunity in Somalia. And it also is able to, as I said, carry out more sophisticated attacks. So its capabilities are growing. There's debate about what kind of threat it will pose to the West. When it comes to these groups, though, without kind of weighing into the various nuances of that particular debate, right now, the way jihadist groups operate is not how they operated in the 1990s. In the 90s, they had something which was called the far enemy strategy. And that the far enemy strategy was specifically to attack the United States, to attack Western countries, because al-Qaeda's view, the view of major strategists within that organization, was that if they came close to toppling regional governments such that they could set up a Sharia-based state or a state ruled by Islamic law, then Western countries, France, the U.S., and others, would step in and stop them from doing that. Over the past few years, particularly since the Arab Spring, it's become clear that that's not the case. The West did not intervene to topple Muammar Gaddafi, and in fact, they didn't intervene to prop up Gaddafi, but rather stepped in to topple him. And al-Qaeda ideologues are actually kind of surprised by that. I read some statements by major al-Qaeda strategists at the time, where when the U.S. intervened, they actually got it wrong. They thought the U.S. was going in to save Gaddafi, and they wrote an entire strategic document premised from that. And so we've seen over the past few years how in Yemen, in you know, in parts of Syria, in parts of Libya, you could have growing strength of jihadist organizations with a minimal outside Western hand. And so as long as they have opportunities in the region, they won't immediately prioritize the U.S. or the West, though that isn't the set of targets that they're ever taking off the table. It's just they have a lot of regional opportunities, and strategically, they're focusing in on expanding those opportunities. So when we look at Shabaab, you have a couple of things. Number one, they have a lot of opportunity in Somalia. Number two, the ability to reach out to the U.S. is somewhat limited from Somalia, though, you know, as is known, the Twin Cities is a little bit of an exception in that regard. There's been some Shabaab recruiting since 2008, 2009 that has gone where people have gone back to Somalia. But that's it's a minor exception. You know, even though there's been a lot of recruiting relative to the U.S., it's not like European levels of recruiting where you have, you know, hundreds or thousands of people going over. And then, you know, the third thing is that as a terrorist organization, even though they're very capable inside Somalia, it's not clear that this is a group that, you know, really has the muscles to carry out a major transnational attack.
Out of Fox News in regards to this story before we move over to ISIS in Raqqa, none of the roughly 400 U.S. troops in Somalia were hurt in the attack. It does say the U.S. military this year has stepped up drone strikes and other efforts against al-Shabaab. Any comment on that and our efforts against this organization in the region?
Well, the U.S. has been involved there for a while,
right,
going back to Shabaab's predecessor, which was called the Islamic Courts Union. And, you know, it's been there's been more of this under the Trump administration than the Obama administration, but only a bit more. I mean, it's been along the same trajectory that was set up under Obama, with perhaps things becoming a bit less covert. That being said, the U.S. involvement is still relatively minimal, and it's targeting only small swaths of the overall Shabaab organization.
And not a huge surprise that at least at the time of this particular story's writing, that al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda, have not commented on the attack yet, taking credit for it, correct?
Well, it could go either way. There are a lot of Shabaab attacks that the group does not take credit for, right? It's different than ISIS in that regard, which tends to immediately take credit for attacks. So, yeah, it's not a huge surprise, but it's one of those things where it could go either way. You wouldn't necessarily expect that they wouldn't claim credit either. Though I think that one thing Shabaab likes to do is to basically keep its enemies guessing when it carries out attacks. They see some advantage in not claiming credit right away.
Out of two different stories here, let's shift over to Raqqa. So we got one here out of ABC News, and it's interesting the way that these stories are positioned. But 100 ISIS fighters surrender in Raqqa in coalition battle to retake the Syrian city. There's also the story out of the Jakarta Post along the same lines. Once promised paradise, IS fighters end up in mass graves. In the opening statement, the Islamic State group once drew recruits from near and far with promises of paradise, but now the bodies of jihadists lie in mass graves or at the mercy of wild dogs as its caliphate collapses.
Yes.
So break this down. I mean, it all sounds good in the battle against ISIS. Is it? Is there progress being made in the wake of this particular news?
No, clearly, yes. You know, ISIS's caliphate is crumbling, and you might actually recall, we've had multiple conversations where I said that this exact thing would be likely to happen.
Yep.
And in fact, I drew an analogy. You'll remember a few years ago, you had this kind of line of analysis where some people thought ISIS was undefeatable. There was an article in the Telegraph, a British newspaper, arguing that we had to recognize ISIS as a state because it wasn't losing the battlefield at all, and it was continuing to make advances, and so we had no choice but to diplomatically recognize it. Such things seem very foolish in retrospect, but at the time, what I pointed to was how the U.S., through bombing campaigns, can basically hollow out a foe so much that the collapse, even when a foe sticks out for a while, the collapse is rapid. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that that ISIS can't make a comeback as an insurgency, and indeed, it's winning the quote-unquote peace that has been the hardest part for the United States. In Iraq, in Afghanistan, we were able to topple a governing entity, first the Taliban, then Saddam Hussein, and now ISIS, which was basically functioning as a governing entity. But it's much harder to then stabilize these areas, and the Afghan war obviously has been going on for 16 years now, and, you know, the Taliban's regime only lasted for the first few months of that war. So, you know, A, the news is good, but B, the bad news is that now comes what has traditionally been the difficult part, that stabilizing a geographic area after the bad guys have collapsed is really hard. And the U.S.'s track record there is not good, nor is the record of the U.S.'s allies.
Is there any reason in your mind, do you see any indication that would increase your confidence with the Trump administration and the directions that they've taken so far, that that might be improved, or do you expect it to continue to sort of be status quo?
I don't see a reason to think that it would improve. For one thing, in Obama, and this is actually consistency between Obama and Trump, we've been somewhat hands-off in terms of stabilization or what sometimes is derisively referred to as nation-building efforts. Mm-hmm. But really, that's kind of the phase that we're quickly moving into, is a stabilization phase. Under Obama, we relied on local allies. That did not go well in Iraq after the U.S. left. That did not go well in Libya. And, you know, Obama, when he was talking about his greatest mistake as U.S. president, interestingly, he shifted the blame for his greatest mistake to someone else. But he said his greatest mistake was assuming that David Cameron would do more to stabilize Libya after the U.S. left. Under Trump, with kind of the nationalist as opposed to globalist agenda, the way that he framed it on the campaign trail, we're getting less involved in kind of the intricacies of trying to fix what is sometimes regarded as other people's problems. So, paradigmatically, I don't see a reason to believe that will change. And the second thing is I see some specific reasons to think there's a lot of trouble here. Another thing that happened over the past couple of days is the Iraqi military is, the way it's framed, though not by the administration, is they're attacking the Kurds in northern Iraq. Right? In northern Iraq, the Kurdish regional government held a vote. They voted for independence from Iraq. And the Iraqi forces are moving into the north against the Peshmerga, against the Kurdish regional government, who's also been an ally of theirs against ISIS, and it's seizing key bases. There's been limited fire between them, and the Trump administration has downplayed this as being a misunderstanding. But you've had this very fragile coalition with lots of actors who hate each other and are at odds with each other, and also who are bound to create grievances within the local population. There have been Iranian-backed Shia militias moving in. There's the Kurdish government and the Iraqi government who are at odds with each other and now may or may not be going to war with each other, all of which means that all these various conflicts and hatreds and tension is going to make it even more difficult to stabilize this area.
Talking with David Gartensteiner-Ross, before we wrap up, how big of an impact does what's happening in Raqqa now, according to Ryan Dillon, the spokesperson, Colonel Ryan Dillon for the anti-ISIS coalition, says there's about 300 to 400 fighters remain. They still expect difficult fighting days ahead and will not set a time for when they think ISIS will be completely defeated. They say they've got about 85% control of the city now. But how big of an impact does it have on ISIS as a whole? And by way of, maybe not example, but is there any thought to a cause of concern of ISIS getting desperate and perhaps wanting to launch an attack on the West in light of these types of defeats?
Yeah, that's obviously a concern. I think it's not, so there's two things that press against that concern. One is I don't see any evidence that ISIS has ever refrained from carrying out attacks.
Hmm. Okay.
Right? Like, it's easy to say, well, they'll get desperate, they'll carry out an attack. But they've already been trying to carry out attacks pretty consistently.
Right.
So I don't see that there's much opportunity to step that up. And secondly, though we haven't seen this yet, you would hope that at some point their capability to carry out attacks abroad would decline. My guess is it actually already is in the decline phase, though we don't know for sure. But I think the area, the time when we'll best know this is next Ramadan, because traditionally this group tries to carry out a Ramadan offensive where it carries out terrorist attacks across multiple countries, including in the West. And this past Ramadan was not as bloody as the previous one. If we see a significant decline next Ramadan, that'll actually be a strong indication that, at least for the time being, its terrorist capabilities are in decline.
We have just a minute, David. Just a quick question, getting back to Al-Shabaab and Somalia. Al-Qaeda, can you, just for a minute, can you speak to where Al-Qaeda stands in all this? I mean, prior to ISIS, that's who we normally would be talking about.
That is a fantastic question. And, one thing that I fault, especially counterterrorism analysts, for is not talking about Al-Qaeda enough over the past few years. ISIS had this terrible strategy. And we have till what, 8:56, is that right?
No, we're actually down to a minute now, unfortunately. I've done it again.
Okay,
and
the answer would normally be fairly complex.
Okay.
I'll frame it in the 45 seconds or less version, which is ISIS was super loud. It made enemies all over the place. Al-Qaeda took advantage of the focus on ISIS and realized that counterterrorism and counterinsurgency resources wouldn't focus on it. And it localized and tried to embed itself within populations. It now has much greater ability to maneuver openly within the region than ever before. That's a real problem. And a year, 2 years from now, people will be talking about Al-Qaeda much, much more.
David Gartenstein-Ross, thank you so much for your time. Always a pleasure. Really enjoy our conversations.
Likewise. Thank you.
Have you on again soon. Take care.
DefendDemocracy.org is the website where you can go find out more about David. Coming up, Vikings knock out Aaron Rodgers. Packers 23-10 win. We'll be talking with voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen, next on Twin Cities News Talk. Justice in